Hostile search strikes up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Today I have Warren Yeomans, local orcharder from Green Hill Orchards in Arding. Good morning, Warren.
Good morning, Herb.
Well, thanks for coming in. Now, you're a local?
I am a local. I've grown up in this area.
Now, I might read something that was written in the Urella Wordsworth, I think, last year. As they sat, Nellie tendered Bill's hand, and while he told a story he had heard in Armidale during his last trip, he had met a couple, John and Emma Yeomans. The Yeomans had come out from Derbyshire, England, a few years earlier, and had bought a nearby farm, naming it Kilchen. Their intention was to plant an orchard to supply seasonal fruit to local market. They had planted a cherry tree of the Florence variety as a start, and John worked on Saumarez Station for the White family and had heard this recent tale through the station workmen. Now tell me, Saumarez Homestead.
Yeah, I believe the Yeomans family, to earn some money to help pay their way, worked at the Saumarez Homestead while looking at land in the area just to establish, a home base.
So when did they come out to Australia?
They came to Australia in 1863 and then ventured up into the Northern Tablelands in 1865.
How did they get to know to come to Australia?
There was a lady by the name of Mary Allsop who was sent to Australia, and after she had served some time, she wrote a letter back to England inviting anybody who wanted to come to Australia that she could find any work that they wanted on their arrival.
Now, it was John and Emma Yeomans. They came to the Hunter and they came up to Armidale. We're talking about 1865.
Yes.
And they bought Kilchen.
Yeah, I understand that the property was originally named Kilchen and then changed in about 1925 to Green Hills.
What was the acreage that they bought?
They started with 120 acres.
And that's 120 acres is still the same 120 acres you've got today?
Yeah, we've still got the original title, yeah, but there is the property's a little bit bigger than that now, though.
And you're the sixth generation?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And you've got children?
I have children, yeah. I've got four children, two boys and two girls.
And a few grandchildren?
And, 12 grandchildren.
12 yeah. grandchildren. And you think that the orchard is safe in their hands?
The orchard, there is some interest, but they're certainly, they're all nine of them are agriculturally influenced. Yeah, there's certainly a rural influence in their lives, yeah.
Great. So let's just go back through the time. What was grown mostly in those early days?
I believe they started with the cherry tree, has been mentioned. Over time, I think families established a land plot and they planted trees, planted a garden to be self-sufficient. Obviously, transport was by horse, so if you can provide your own food, that would minimise the need to outsource for that. So I believe that the orchard probably generated as a supply mechanism for other people over time.
So back in those days, though, there would have been a lot of different orchard because people were probably selling the surplus they'd made to make a bit of extra coin.
Yeah, although I'm not sure when the orchard industry in this area really started to take off, but I think it'd be more sometime later. But certainly most people in the summer months would have had a surplus supply of food.
And I note you've got a very old pear tree right next to the packing shed, and you think it might be pretty old?
Yeah, well, the Department of Agriculture was involved with grafting the different varieties onto that tree in the 1920s, and history says that there were 17 varieties, but I can at the moment only count seven, and we look after that tree. It's very large. It's sort of in that 6 metre tall size, could be a bit more, and very large girth, but quite a tree of notoriety.
What is the original stock of that tree?
There's only really one known pear rootstock these days, and it's called D6. Sounds like a bulldozer, but it's Pyrus calariana. Back in those days, it may have been just a seed planted and then grafted onto the seedling.
So it's got six different grafts on it?
Seven that I know of.
Are any of those grafts you're still producing today?
All of them produce fruit, yeah. Most of them are not known varieties in the commercial realm today, but there's certainly one of notoriety is the large pear that we grow on there as well.
What's that variety? What's that variety?
That variety is called Yuvedale St. Germain, and it dates back to Kent in England in 1670 when it was named. And it's a parent variety of the Packham pear, which is actually an Australian bred variety. Its origin is in Molong. But we actually held a world record at one stage for the largest pear in the world off that tree.
Tell me some details about that.
Pear weighed in at 2.1 kilos, so that was quite a large piece of fruit, and managed to be able to track down the Guinness Book of Records and get it recognised.
What year was that?
1999.
Fantastic. You grew up learning the orchard trade with your grandfather, Clary Yeomans?
Yeah, I left school in 1977 on the Friday and started work on the Monday, and I'm still there. Yeah, so, but Clary, my grandfather, was working there at the time, so I got to work with my dad and his brother, my uncle, and my grandfather. And then my grandfather was due to retire, but I think it took him 20 years to work his way out of it.
And I know that he died in 2012 at 99 years of age.
That's right, yeah. So he had a long life. He lived on the property. He was actually born on the property, and he lived there for 99 years and just had the last 3 months of his life in the aged care. And his mother lived on the property as well, and she lived to 104, so... The longevity's there.
Oh, well, I hope that is passed on through your whole family.
Yeah.
Your father, Ken, is still working around the front property?
Yeah, he's obviously with diminishing responsibilities, but he enjoys living on the property as well.
And his brother, Russell, your uncle, used to be on there, but he's now retired.
Yeah, he's retired, but there's been a long family history there.
Let's just go through a few things about the different varieties that you have. Cherries are your production?
Cherries we grow in December, and we have about 15 varieties. We have a large number of varieties, mostly to give us continuity, so different varieties ripen at different times, and so that sort of gives us a sort of out of a 4 to 5 week harvest window.
So that's cherries, 15 varieties of cherries. Apples?
Apples we just concentrate on about 4 varieties, which is the Gala, Fuji, Pink Lady and Granny Smith. And we do have a couple other varieties. We have a little bit of Golden Delicious, and we're moving into a Crimson Crisp variety and looking at new varieties, but yeah, just concentrate more on just a few.
I think the Pink Ladies are my daughter's favourite.
Yes, well, Pink Ladies over 50% of Australia's production, so it's a well-known and popular variety.
Our pears?
Pears, well, there's obviously a history with pears on our property, but still have the main 3 varieties, which is the Packham Pear, Bury Bosc. Well, they're the 2 main ones, but we also have a different one called Red D'Anjou, which is quite outstanding because of its dark purple skin colour. It is a skin colour. The flesh is white.
And I did notice that you're selling pear juice in large glass bottles.
Yeah, pear juice is a unique product. We do a blend of different pears, so there is a place for it. You know, some people have medical needs, and the pear juice is recommended, and so that's a one... aspect of that, but it's a nice juice as well, yeah, to consume for consumption.
Nice with ice on a hot day.
Nice with ice, and can be watered down if it's a bit too much. Yeah, just a nice, cool, refreshing drink.
And where do you get that juiced?
We take it to Stanthorpe. There's a producer up there. He sort of was a fruit grower and then gradually transitioned into juice. And but he's got the facilities that can manufacture the product from the fruit efficiently.
Now, you tell me about your catchment area in terms of your sales of your product. Obviously, and we'll talk about it right at the end, about how people can actually go to the orchard. You can't pick your own, but you can go to the orchard, go to the packing house and buy straight from the producer. But tell me about your catchment area now in this current climate.
Well, we work with supplying, you know, within sort of 100 kilometres. Coast is a bit further than that. The orchard industry has diminished somewhat, particularly in the last 20 years. I would say post-Second World War, when the soldier settlement blocks were established, particularly south of Ural in the Kentucky area, there was a large fruit-growing business. Over the years, the industry has diminished. So I'm the last man standing, so I believe that my market is the local market, and that's where I concentrate to supply.
So supplying within 100 kilometres, but you're the last man standing or person standing within a couple of 100 kilometres.
Yeah, Stanthorpe would be the next major commercial orchard operational area. And going south would be Orange, so, you know, there's a fair distance between us.
And what outlets do you supply?
We've just been concentrating on supplying fruit shops and also moving into supplying some people who do weekend markets, coastal markets, and also some local. That's an ongoing transition as to food distribution and how we fit into that system.
So that's places like Tamworth Mall, grocer-type sort of outlets?
Yeah, there's one in Katingle that we supply, and also the fruit shop in Tamworth. And then there's some fruit shops on the coast and also that we supply. And there's a
Dorigo, Bellingen.
Yeah, that's right, and Port Macquarie. Not much west, but there's an outlet in Bingra as well.
Urella, Armidale?
Yeah, Urella, yeah, and Armidale definitely, yeah.
What's the shop in Urella?
The Foodworks.
Foodworks,
yeah,
and the...
And some juice goes also through the Seasons of New England shop in Urella as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And up in Armidale?
The Market Fresh in Armidale. They are good supporter of local producers.
Well, I was talking to Dino in the last podcast, and he supplies sells a lot of his trout out of that shop. Up in Gyra?
No, we don't have any outlets in Gyra at the moment, no, but some people do come from Gyra to us, though.
All right, they get it themselves.
Yeah.
So we might have just a little break and compose ourselves. We'll come back very shortly and talk about the seasons at the orchard. We'll be back in a minute.
If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.
And you're back with me, Herb, and we are Community Spotlight on Warren Yeomans, one of our local orchardists at Arding, Greenhill Orchards. Long history of orchardry in our local area, 1865, distant relative, six generations ago, established Kilchin, which then was changed in the early 1900s to Greenhill Orchards. So welcome back, Warren.
Thank you.
So we're going to go now through the seasons of the orchard. Now, we're in winter now. So what happens in winter?
Well, it doesn't look like much is happening, but there's always the pruning work to be done to get the trees back into shape and set them up for production. The orchard floor management, you know, with soil nutrition and looking at what remediation might need to happen there with the nutritional requirements. And there's also fruit in storage, so there's fruit being sold, you know, week by week as well.
So tell me how you grade your apples.
Yeah, sorting fruit is obviously the visual aspect of the fruit. You know, if it looks, you know, if there's any colour deficiencies or if there's any marks, because yeah, you know, we do have seasonal variations, you know, hail, but even pest and disease issues. So any visual defects that are on the fruit and odd shapes, yeah, if they're uneven. So there is a certain standards that we need to come to, you know, with the presentation of the fruit. So we have what is normally a first and second grade. Then anything that doesn't make that goes into a third grade, but there's an outlet for that. You know, several people have birds and other animals that they feed, you know, with the downgrade fruit.
So that grading is really consumer dominated, not necessarily the quality of the flesh inside.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's my saying is we buy with our eyes and we come back for flavour.
Very good. So winter. Now tell me, pruning during winter, why is pruning important?
Pruning is important to maintain the height of the tree and the width, you know, assessing buds that are on the tree, so it can be a means of reducing crop load even before they start to produce fruit. So it's setting up the shape of the tree. There's pruning techniques involved in managing even the year ahead as well. So it's not just the crop one season ahead, but it's even 2 and 3 years ahead. And also with the shape of the tree, we're looking at pest and disease management and harvestability of the fruit. So we're trying to make everything as simple as possible. So, you know, when it comes to harvest, that the fruit's readily accessible, you know, to pickers who come in to do that task.
Pickers. So first, let's go back to the pruners. Is it done by hand or is it done by machine?
Well, say, if we go back in time, it was done by hand. So there's hand pruners and even loppers and hand saws. Quite a few years ago, we moved to pneumatic, you know, air-powered pruners, and that sped up the process, you know, many times, you know, 10 times quicker than hand pruners. And so your brain got tired rather than your hand in trying to think ahead of the machine. But we're now moving into electric saws and electric pruners, so that the quietness of that is quite incredible compared to having an engine running all the time producing air. And the electric pruners are phenomenal in their productivity as well.
How many people do you employ to do the pruning, just say, for winter?
One person can do all of our pruning if they're at it throughout the winter.
And that's the 20 acres that you've got planted?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you told me off air that the 20 acres is probably, it's the original 20 acres, but you're more intensive now.
Yeah, well, originally the orchard design would be that tree would be planted 24 feet apart, you know, which is close to 6 metres. Our most intense orchards now would be about 4 metres in the aisle, and the trees would be about, you know, a metre apart. Yeah, the orchard, the trees, we're looking at smaller trees but more intensely planted and with your supplementation with irrigation and grass management.
Gotcha. So let's go into, so we've just finished with winter, fertilising, pruning, shaping the trees, maintenance around the farm. Spring, what are we doing in spring?
Spring, well, we're looking at the potential crop load. There's always the ongoing emergence of diseases, like fungal diseases potentially, and in the emergence of the first signs of insects, like with codling moth particularly, just looking at strategies to control or keep those things in check.
And I note when I was down there last, I saw some fruit fly traps and some codling moth devices. Tell me about those.
Well, codling moth, we use what's called mating disruption. Female moth produces a pheromone, which is an attraction for the male moth. So there's a synthetic pheromone distributed throughout the orchard. So when the male moth emerges, he can smell female, but he can't find. So no mating, no egg laying. And that's made a huge difference to the pest disease management.
Gotcha. And fruit fly, would you be doing much with fruit fly?
Fruit fly is by far our biggest challenge, because they go through several generations in a season. They can almost go through a cycle every 2 weeks. And because fruit flies are direct pests, they lay their eggs in the fruit. Being able to intercept that is a problem. There's several strategies. There's baiting, where we try and attract the flies to a bait source, which kills them before they even get to the maturity stage. Then looking at traps, where they are attracted to different traps. But the thing is that the juveniles eat differently to the adults and the males eat differently to the females. So there's different traps, different methods for different stages of the insect.
So that tells me that it's a constant war against the pests on the orchard. You've got your codling moth for your apples and I'm assuming your pears, and your fruit fly for your stone fruit and your cherries. Summer, what's happening in summer?
Well, in summer months, with the cherries, because they start to ripen in the beginning of summer, so we're harvesting fruit pretty well straight away. And then there's the ongoing management of the other crops as they're emerging as well, like if the development, if there's any irrigation needs or any other pest and disease management.
Cherries are one of your biggest. You've got 15 varieties of cherries to cater for all situations, but that's our summer Christmas fair. How many cherries would you sell? How many ton?
Yeah, close to 5 ton.
5 ton, that's all for the local market.
Yes.
And you sell a lot out of the store, because I've been there and there's been lines of people.
Yeah.
So is the answer, order your cherries for Christmas?
It's a bit of a problem for us if we order cherries. So I can't just duck out the back and pick up a box. I've got to have it in the system. So it's a bit of a short-term thing that if you want cherries, you contact us to see if we actually have them available.
Yeah. So to contact you, I noticed that you've got both a Facebook page and a website.
Yeah.
And they've got the phone numbers on there and also contact us function for an email.
Yeah, with the Facebook too, it gives you short-term advice on your seasonal conditions, because wet weather plays up with the cherries a bit. And yeah, so Facebook gives us an up-to-date sort of means of keeping people informed of what's going on.
Now, I'm just thinking ahead out of winter into summer and spring into summer and now Christmas. Cherries are mostly hail-proof?
Yeah, we have at least half of our crop under net, and so it's not only hail-proof, but it's bird-proof as well. And that's one of our, not only people like cherries, there's many shapes and sizes of animals that like to eat them as well. So we've actually got them fully enclosed, and that's made a world of difference to our productivity in that space. But we also do throw over nets over other trees as well.
All right, so we've moved out of Christmas and we're in autumn now. So tell me what happens in autumn.
Well, autumn, we've moved through the other zone fruits that we have, and in February we're looking at harvesting the first of the apples, which is Gala, and then pears and the picked in February into early March. Apples continue right through to May, so there's different varieties at different parts of the season.
So, yeah, the apples are the lovely and fresh apples. You can go out and buy them straight from the orchardman. Warren usually, if nobody's around, just wait a minute and he'll ride up on his quad bike and sell you some apples. You don't have to have cash. You can pay by card. I've seen there's a square reader on the counter.
Yep. Yeah, that's post-COVID. That was one of the things that we had to move into, but that's proved quite handy.
So we've done winter, spring, summer and autumn, and we've talked about the grading, and there's a cold store. So how long does your apples and pears last in cold store?
We have four cool rooms, and we don't always use them all, but we have the ability to store them long term, which is sort of getting into not just managing the temperature but managing the atmosphere within the room, so we can seal the room and bring the oxygen level down to about 2 or 2.5%. Apples, pears, fruit, they breathe like we do. They breathe in oxygen and give off carbon dioxide, and so by managing the amount of oxygen available to them, it just extends their shelf life.
So tell me, Tom, your son, he's doing something a little bit interesting with pest management. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he's sort of ventured into looking at, well, certainly looking at the nutritional status of the trees, which is also the nutritional status of the soil that we grow the trees in, and then also looking at establishing a nutritional status of the tree where it becomes more resilient or resistant to pest and disease. So not only fungal diseases like black spot and powdery mildew, but also the insects aren't attracted to the trees as well.
So is that to say that the healthier the tree, the more resilient they are to pest attack?
Yeah, so but then looking at the health status is sort of becomes, the deeper you go, the more scientific it gets, but certainly micronutrients have macro effects on the productivity, the storability, the disease resistance and of the fruit that we grow.
So where is this research coming from? I think you mentioned somebody in Stanthorpe.
There's a fellow by the name of Graham Slate in Stanthorpe, and there's also an American bloke called John Kemp. Their research is quite interesting.
And Tom's following down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, Tom has a mind for this sort of stuff, and he's researching it quite a lot and implementing the ideas as well.
And he's on farm with you?
He works on the farm with me, yep.
Oh, fantastic. Now, the one thing I wanted to talk to you about is water. So how do you water these trees, this 20 acres?
Yeah, well, obviously, in years gone by, it's been reliant on rainfall, and we do have a good rainfall area in that we're summer dominant, so we do get good rain in December, January. We have implemented irrigation, so we have trickle or micro jet irrigation in the orchards. We have a dam that we irrigate from, and we also have underground sources, and so that fills the gaps here where there's dry times and seasons to be able to keep the trees functioning.
So as an intensive sort of agricultural enterprise, using trickle irrigation and your way you're irrigating the trees would be pretty efficient in water use?
Very water use, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of just applying directly to where you need it.
Yeah, great. Now tell me about the drought. So we've been through a few droughts.
Yeah.
That's the nature of the cycle of seasons, and it may be that it's going to get worse for us. We don't know what climate change. The predictions are there, but we don't know really what it will mean. The last big dry that we had, how did you handle that?
The 2019 drought was the drought of all droughts, you know, in recorded history. For us, pretty big challenge because we're living with trees that are in the ground. At the time, in the winter of 2019, my view was that the ground was far too dry to start into spring. And so, because I had no water on the ground, but I had water in the ground, I irrigated through the winter to get the trees established, to create a base under them. And I think that really helped them get through the summer months.
So what was your end result during that drought by taking that action?
Well, I produced 20% of what I normally produce, which, considering the lack of rainfall, I think was a pretty good achievement. I mean, the trees survived. We had no deaths from dry, but the trees certainly were stressed, you know, from the dry. But overall, I think we managed to get through quite well.
So that tells me that you do have a drought response management mechanism, a lever to pull. Similarly with Dino, when I talked to Dino from Dino Smoked Trouts from Black Mountain, his response to drought was not produce any fish, buy his fish in from another source that had thing. He could do his smoking. He could still operate his enterprise in terms of his smoked fish. And when rains returned, he started producing. And similarly, you've done the same sort of mechanism. You said, all right, I'll make sure my tree have water underneath them. Obviously, they're permanent plantings, and to get through water early and get them through, and you didn't lose any, and you still produced 20% of what you would have.
Yes, that's right. I think also with this nutritional aspect as well, that looking at the cycling of water in the soil, that's another aspect of the nutrition program that we're looking at as well, that make better use of the water that's there and maintain the water, you know, in the environment that the trees are working or living and growing in.
It all sounds very good. You're a very hard-working fellow. How many people do you employ?
There's a family member, so there's myself and my son Tom, and there's casual staff as we need, so there's at least, you know, one or two people part-time.
And do you have many pickers when the picking is right?
When the cherries are on, we have about 10 or 15 people, depending on how much fruit there is. That's only short-term for about 3 weeks. And then with the apples and pears, it could be three or four people.
Well, I think this has been really insightful. I didn't realise how busy an orchard person would be. But a couple of details before we finish up. So there is a Facebook page and a website. If you just Google Greenhill Orchards, maybe add Arding, it'll come straight up. And you'll find out there's contact details there. The Facebook will keep you up to date with the fruit that's available at any one time. But do yourself a favour and actually go and visit the orchard and meet Warren. He's always up for a chat, as you've just heard. So you basically go along Arding Road. So off the highway, you go Arding Road, past Greenhill Kennels, and then the first turn to the left is Hawthorne Drive. And a couple of hundred metres up there, there's the entranceway to the orchards. Now, he's open 10 till 5 weekdays and Saturday, not open Sunday. And again, you can't pick your own fruit, but go out there, and the fruit's really reasonably priced. Just on that note, Warren, I thank you for coming in. You're a real gem in our community of the last orchard person standing within a couple of hundred kilometres. I think we said 350 kilometres or something.
About that, yeah.
And you're supplying all the local produce outlets, all the ones around the place, the Katingal one, and you're doing juiced pears as well. Thank you for coming in to Community Spotlight, and I wish you all the best with your orchard to come.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Herb.
If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.